It's not like you can just decide, you know what, I'm not going to follow this path at all. I'm going to just burrow through the ground, and then I'm going to kill the crow people, and then I'm going to become the queen of the Monument Valley. This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also very lucky to welcome Ken Wong of Us2 Games. Ken is the designer and artist behind Monument Valley, the spectacular new iOS game that is currently bending minds around the world. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
So our topic today is games as art and the incredible explosion of games over the last few years that, in my mind, have proven that games are really an art form. And that's why I'm excited to have Ken on the show today, because this week Ken's team launched Monument Valley, which is an incredibly beautiful game. It's really, really is a work of art. If you haven't had a chance to play it yet, it's only an hour long, so you can and should download it. It's on the App Store, and give it a play. It's quite remarkable. So I wanted to kick things off by asking Ken, how did the idea of making a work of art or creating a work of art factor into the process of making Monument Valley?
Well, first of all, it's great to be on the show and to be talking about a subject that I'm really passionate about. I guess, you know, when we started the project, when we embarked on making Monument Valley, it wasn't really an established goal to make art or prove anything in that sense. We were just looking for the next game project that we could work on. As a new team, the team was kind of reformed at the time, and I guess, you know, the aim was always just let's make the best game we can, whatever form that takes. And this idea that we settled on, Monument Valley, a game about architecture and forgiveness, I guess ended up being very personal to me, and I drew on a lot of the themes that that I've explored in my own personal art and that I'm very passionate about. And I guess somewhere along the way, people started talking about it as art. And it's almost a bit of a mundane thing to talk about, because of course games can be art. To me, it's never been a question. The problem is just that we're in the early stages of our art form. It's only been around for a few decades, and you know, film and recorded music and theater and architecture have been around much longer. And so, you know, people have developed a vocabulary and a system for critiquing these other art forms, whereas we're still working on that for video games through podcasts like this. So I have never doubted that video games can be art, and I'm really happy that the game has turned out to be sort of a conversation piece in this regard.
Yeah, I don't know if maybe they were not the three best people to argue, like, whether or not games are art, because to me, it's not really a question. To you, it's not really a question. I'm not sure how much, I mean, I think Nigel may be slightly less extreme in his position on it, but I mean, to me, it seems very like once you play Journey or a game like Monument Valley, there's enough games out there. I mean, even I think Bioshock might have been a turning point for me where I was like, yeah, this is definitely. Especially when you consider all the stuff that's to come, this is definitely an art form. But even that game itself, I would say.
Yeah, I would say I'm definitely firmly in the games can be art camp. I think the if we want to state sort of the opposing position, that the games can't be art position in a like fair way, as opposed to just the grumpy old man kind of view that some people that are gamers have of that kind of opinion. I think it is fair to say that less games are art than in some other mediums. That's one of the things that Roger Ebert, who is sort of the most articulate person on the games can't be art side, when that debate really flared up a couple years ago, one of the things that he said that I thought was really smart is, you know, someone asked him, well, how can you consider like some dumb action movie like Transformers or Pearl Harbor to be art, but not some of these great video games? And he said, well, that's easy. I don't consider those to be art. And I think that's a reasonable way to look at it, is that games, because they're focused on entertainment and engaging the manual dexterity of the user in a way that film and television and books aren't, it's definitely easier for them to not be art, to be more just like a form of, I don't want to use the word like mindless entertainment, but like entertainment without any significance to it, entertainment without any emotional weight, because what games are trying to do is something different. And it's only the really exceptional games that I think rise to that level of being art. And that's different from something like film or television or, maybe television is a good example of that, because I think television has some of the same problems that probably the majority of television that's broadcast I wouldn't necessarily consider to be art. Whereas movies, probably most of the movies are art. And books, I would say almost all of them are really art. Same thing with, fine art, like sculpture or painting. Like virtually all of those we could characterize as art, as opposed to appealing to some baser instinct in people.
Yeah, I think Roger Ebert's claim that only masterpieces are art, like he didn't take that position that most movies are art, but really bad ones aren't. He basically took the position that if something is a masterpiece that moves you to tears and will be, you know, held up for generations to come, or maybe even centuries, you know, if it's Hamlet or the Mona Lisa, that's art. But, you know, maybe even like Breaking Bad, or, you know, something that at the time seems, you know, it's really popular and it seems to have emotional weight, maybe if it's not a masterpiece, it's not art. And I think the only thing that raises is not like, you know, even if you took that position, it seems clear to me that the Hamlet of video games is coming, even if it's not here yet.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
No?
No, I feel I would want to disagree with both of your positions. My position is that I like to be an inclusivist. So I feel like if we have to have a definition for art, that it should be quite broad. I saw a quote from Picasso the other day, and if I may paraphrase, he said something like, all children are artists, and some of us just forget how to be an artist. And, you know, I think art is about creation and expression, no matter how mundane or base that is. So, you know, despite my objections to the Transformers franchise, I wouldn't deny it if some people claimed that it had some artistic integrity. I'm actually a big fan of Michael Bay or his selected works anyway. And it's the same with video games. Obviously, it's quite easy to argue that something like BioShock or Journey are works of art. But I think the debate becomes more interesting when you look at something like Space Invaders or Pac-Man or Super Mario Brothers. You know, these are interesting because they came at a time when it wasn't possible to sort of harness the language of cinema or even of books to convey story and meaning through a video game. So the text of what those games are, it's all interaction. It's pure gameplay, you know. So I think the debate becomes more interesting when you say, like, you know, how can pure gameplay be considered art? And I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, well, you actually had a quote, Ken, from the Us2 blog, I believe, where you talked about sort of like, what does it mean for a game to be described as art, and it hit on two things that are really commonly discussed. And, you know, I'm not an art major, if you didn't guess. But one of the common things that comes up is the expression of the artist, and one of the other things that comes up is delivering like a moving emotional experience to the person who's experiencing the art. And those two things can actually sometimes kind of be in conflict and can cause very different outlooks on whether or not you think something is art. Like you could, if the person who was making Space Invaders had this incredibly deep artistic vision, even if no one else really sort of, or most people who played it didn't absorb it, then by that way you could say, oh, it was a work of art from the creator's perspective. Vice versa, you could have a circumstance where someone almost accidentally creates art by creating something that actually really does move people and really creates a meaningful impact on people, even if they didn't think of themselves as an artist. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. I think you also have to consider, you know, what is the value of defining art? And what are we arguing about anyway, whether something is art or it isn't? If, you know, millions of people enjoy something, then does it mean that it has value? I mean, I think just because something is in a museum doesn't mean that it's great or worthy of great, you know, glory or worship. I guess I feel like the term art has become a bit redundant. You know, it's not useful anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that get lumped in under that umbrella of art, and different art forms are so different. I think the point is very fair of like, you know, is gameplay art? You know, when we talk about whether or not games are art, usually we're focusing on the aspects that are like other media, right? We'll say this is a piece of art because it has like a really interesting look. Like Journey and Monument Valley both have gotten a lot of attention for how visually arresting they are, you know? Like they look very different from the other games that are out there and have a very you know, that really impacts people the way they look. But that's, you know, that's essentially treating them in some ways like a piece of visual art, like talking about them in those terms. Similarly, games that are well respected for their story, you know, you're talking about them in the same way that you're talking about film or literature. And those portions of the gaming experience, I think it's easy to, you know, to try and come up with some way that those relate to other pieces of art to try and answer that question. But gameplay is something new. Like gameplay is it's the innovation of video games. It's the things that make them different as a medium from those other forms of entertainment. And yeah, we don't have that critical language for talking about it. We don't have years of experience with, you know, with how gameplay works and what pieces of gameplay have, you know, have emotional weight to really even answer those questions in a way that we can relate to that previous experience with other art forms.
I think that there's a tension with gameplay in that when we think about trying to tell a story and using games as a medium for expression, which is, I think, being a medium of expression is something that a lot of people are getting at when they talk about art, whether or not they want to be inclusivist. Like I tend to agree with Ken, even though I was taking the Roger Ebert side just for the sake of devil's advocate. I tend to be fairly inclusive in saying that, you know, many more things can be a medium of expression than some people might say. But there is a tension in between when you give decisions to the players, and you have branching paths and you have sort of emergent gameplay that you can't necessarily predict or craft, it becomes harder to tell a story that you had in mind when you were creating the game. So if you look at something like Monument Valley, it's it's obvious that you're making decisions as a player as you go through, but it's not like you can just decide, you know what, I'm not going to follow this path at all. I'm going to just burrow through the ground, and then I'm going to kill the crow people, and then I'm going to become the queen of the Monument Valley. You know what I mean? Like, there's still, like, in order to tell the story that it tells, that, you know, gives it its emotional weight, to some degree, you have to limit the sort of range of gameplay that you can make available, even just practically, as like a, you know, developer only has so many resources. And so the kind of interesting question to me is, like, you know, how do you balance that tension in between giving options and telling a story?
There's also a certain degree to which the, like, if you give enough options, you're not necessarily creating art if you want to use a reduced definition of art, which I think my view is probably a little bit more reductionist than either of you guys, but certainly not as far as someone like Roger Ebert. Like, I'd be willing to kick reality TV shows out of the art tent, for example, but you know, like, most movies I'm willing to let in. But if you're going to be reductionist about it, you know, you could say something like, well, is Minecraft art? And I could accept the argument that it isn't, but I wouldn't necessarily be willing to accept the argument that Minecraft isn't a tool for other people to create art. That some of the things that people have made in Minecraft are very clearly art. You know, that some of those Minecraft levels that people build are really sort of pieces of digital sculpture as much as they are a game. And so giving options may reduce your artiness quotient for the thing that you're creating itself, but it increases its value as a tool for the users to sort of make their own art out of it, which I think is a really interesting way to think about that relationship.
Right. I guess, you know, you can extend that to other areas of creation where there is an aspect of expression, but then perhaps also an aspect of functionality. I was just thinking about, say, cinematography, and how, you know, part of a cinematographer's job is to, you know, light everything correctly and, you know, follow the director's vision, and sort of just capture what the actors and the set pieces are. But then there's also an aspect of their job, which is to create, which is related to photography, you know, in order to capture beauty and you know, using their own personal artistic self, enhance that. Packaging design, perhaps, or let's say industrial design, you know, is the iPhone or the iPod a work of art?
Yes.
Well, I think the majority of designers don't really spend their days, you know, wondering whether it's art. They just get along with design, and that's good enough for them. And I think what sort of upsets me is when normal people, you know, like, was it Alan? You just said that you're clearly not an art major.
Yeah, maybe not clearly, but then. I'm not.
Okay. Well, you know, when people see my illustration work and they say, I don't know anything about art, but I like what I see. And I'm like, great, you know, you don't have to know anything about art. If what you're looking at gives you some sort of response, then that's it. I've somehow conveyed something to you, and perhaps it's something that can't be put into words. And so, like, I would like it if everyday normal people could have conversations about art without worrying about, you know, whether they've read enough books or gone to school for it. And I think that's where games is at a really interesting place, because it is sort of one of those art forms that is celebrated by regular people, and maybe they don't spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, what are the underlying themes of this game and what's the subtext here, but they are getting a really interesting experience, and in a way that they couldn't otherwise.
to me, good art definitely should speak to you, even if you don't have the critical language, right? Like, it's, you know, some of those elements are interesting, particularly to creators of the art. Like, if you're making theater or you're making sculpture or something like that, like, you need to think critically about how you're doing and why it's working and why particular things work for the audience and don't. But ultimately, you shouldn't have to know that stuff in order to appreciate the art. That good art should speak to people independent of their critical grounding. And, you know, art forms can get kind of insular and hostile to outsiders if they don't follow that. And certainly, you know, there's plenty of accusations of, like, the fine art community doing that they get really, you know, really insular, and that only people in the know care about those things. And yeah, that can be a problem for an art form. Like, that can hurt an art form.
And that happens in games too. Like, if you look at Counter-Strike, it's impossible for 99% of people to enjoy Counter-Strike because 1% of people are so good at it that you can't really get whatever is there. And I think Monument Valley is a good example of, you know, having taken that path where most people in the world could probably complete it. Like, it doesn't require Twitch dexterity, it doesn't require a whole background of, you know, a decade of experience playing games. Is that something, Ken, that was an intentional thing to make it accessible, or did that just fall out of the design naturally?
It wasn't a goal right from the start of the project. I think one thing that I think went right on the production is that we left our vision for the game very organic. Like, we didn't really have a vision. We sort of advanced step by step and figuring out what is this game going to be good at and what is it not going to be good at. And I guess somewhere along the way, I realized that I was making a game for myself. And I don't really have the time to play long-form games anymore, or I don't have the attention span, you know. So there's all these great games coming out, your Bioshocks and your Grand Theft Autos, and I'm never going to be able to complete even a fraction of Grand Theft Auto because there was a time when I would, you know, sit down for many hours of a day or many hours of a week to immerse myself in this virtual environment, and that's just not my lifestyle anymore. And so I've actually felt kind of a bit excluded from the games industry because I don't get to experience a lot of what people consider to be real video games, if you know what I mean. And in the meantime, I'm still engaging in Street Fighter and in Threes on the iPhone. And I wish that people would accept these as sort of, you know, as valid games, and they have as much to say as I think long form AAA games do.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a tension in among people in the industry and critics and players about how much being hard is an important factor in a game being good or entertaining or successful or worthwhile. In Street Fighter, obviously, the difficulty kind of comes naturally out of playing against other people who are good. But something like Threes, like, it's not punishing. You know, you will eventually die, but you're just kind of are having fun, and it's not exclusive. Like, there isn't 90% of people out there who can't even add 1 + 2, you know.
Threes is also a good example, I think, of how much better a game can be by adding in a little character to the game, right? Like, you know, Threes famously has sort of suffered from pioneering a new genre and then being endlessly ripped off because it's so easy to build a game like that. But Threes is the only one of those I play because it's the only one that feels interesting. Like, even though the others have similar to identical gameplay, they just don't have the sense of, like, fun and whimsy that Threes does. And that's, you know, that's what I find appealing about it as much as the actual gameplay. Like, the gameplay is good, but there's so many other ways you could get your fix of that gameplay that it's got to do something different. And in my opinion, Threes does, which makes it, a, you know, maybe the others are art as well. But to me, Threes is a better piece of art, you know, aside from the distinction of is something art or not. I think we can all agree that there's some pieces of art that are good and some that aren't good. And I would definitely put it in the good category and some of its competition in the not good category.
Sure. I think, you know, part of the reason we're having this discussion is that there's perhaps an old school of belief that the core of a game is challenge, or it's just the mechanics of the gameplay. And I guess that's a whole sort of something we're holding over from the days, the very primitive days when the most straightforward way of making a game was setting it up like a challenge, like a score challenge, or to be competitive. And it was very much based on the mechanics because the sound and the audio was so primitive. But now that we have better tools to create sort of an aesthetic experience and a storytelling experience, a narrative experience, I think we can question the role that gameplay and challenge play in within games. So that was a very conscious decision on Monument Valley that we wouldn't increase the difficulty linearly like you tend to on a single player game. It gets a little bit more challenging as you go along, but then it kind of plateaus because we still wanted everyone to enjoy it. And there are people out there who are criticizing the game for not increasing the difficulty and not having challenging enough puzzles. But that wasn't the point. You know, that wasn't what we were trying to put together. There is something to be said for... Well, let me put it this way. In another interview, someone said, Monument Valley feels like a maze, you know, both visually and in the design of it. And I thought about it and I was like, you know, Monument Valley is actually closer to a labyrinth. And the difference between a maze and a labyrinth is that in a maze, there are lots of choices. And there are many choices that lead to dead ends, which are the wrong answer, and only one path that leads to the finish. Whereas a labyrinth is just one winding path. And often, you can actually see everything. There's no walls. It's just perhaps lines on the ground. And so a labyrinth is more about just walking a path to the end. So it's more about the journey. And that's what I think Monument Valley is closer to that concept, that by walking this journey, by interacting with it, by doing it yourself, you are experiencing something. And it's not about choice, but it's still about interaction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head about it being about the journey in the context of, like, what is one of the most sort of artistically acclaimed games of all time, Journey. The only, and this is something I hadn't really realized until after I'd finished the game, I was trying to describe it to someone. The only dialogue text in the entire game is the fact that the game is titled Journey. Right?
Yeah. It's a brilliant name for the game. And when it came time for us to name our game, I'm like, man, they took the best name.
It's interesting. Like I think I probably put myself a little more in the gameplay camp. Like, and it's not even that I think that that there isn't room for games without challenge, but I do like challenge. Like, that's
sure
part of what I enjoy as a game player. I'd rather have something that's challenging than something that's just visual arresting. Like, for me, I really enjoyed Monument Valley, even though it's a game that's sort of going into it with that. Like, if I told you that in advance, you might be nervous, like, oh, maybe you're not going to like it. But I did enjoy it because I felt like it had the right amount of challenge, and the other stuff that it had going on was really interesting. That the sort of glimpses you see of the story and you know, the connections you make of like what's probably happened in this world and what's happening to Ida, you know, it's an interesting story, and it's not something that's just a, like, we're telling a story, right? It's not written out like, okay, then this happened and then this happened. You get glimpses of the story, which I always find a more interesting way to view a story than just being told it. And it's got a really interesting visual style, you know, that every level's kind of delightful. And so that, I was like, yeah, okay, it's not super challenging, but I still really enjoyed it because I knew going into it that was what it is like. For me, an example of something that didn't work is Dear Esther, which I did not like and did not play more than like half an hour or an hour into, even though, you know, it's one of those things that's kind of acclaimed for being that sort of emotional experience, but without any challenge. Is there was just too little challenge, and I wasn't finding the story interesting enough in what I played. What you got to do with stuff like that, though, I think if you want to be fair to those games, like I would never recommend to someone else that they shouldn't play Dear Esther. Like the things that they set out to do, they accomplished. Those things just aren't interesting to me, right? It's the same way I wouldn't say to someone, oh, you shouldn't watch Transformers. Like it's, you know, it's a little too dumb an action movie for me, but I can appreciate movies that are almost as dumb as it, and like I understand that if you're into just like watching stuff blow up, like lots of stuff blows up in it, you know, there's no question about that. So part of thinking about this stuff critically is not jumping from this thing didn't work for me to this thing is bad, and it's something that's hard not to do. Like people want to be able to say, here's my subjective experience of this, and that's the right experience to have. And part of being a good critic is trying to get past that a little bit. Like, you know, to bring Roger Ebert back into it from another angle, like that's the thing one of the things I always enjoyed about him as a film critic is he was really good about approaching movies kind of on their own terms and being willing to give a good score to a movie that was just kind of dumb fun that he sort of recognized, like, yep, this is dumb fun. There's nothing deep going on here, but it's good at what it does. Or sort of noting where things were his personal reaction and other people might have different reactions. And I think that's part of what makes a good critic is to be able to say, these things didn't work for me, but they might work for you. And for me, gameplay is definitely one of those things that I need some challenge to approach a game and enjoy it. And if there's no challenge at all, or if there's only a little bit of challenge and the other things that are there aren't at the highest level of quality and aren't working for me in their own terms, I'm going to have a hard time enjoying it. And like I said, that's exactly what happened to me with Dear Esther.
Right. I 100% agree with you. And first of all, thank you for the things that you said about Monument Valley. That's really nice to hear. And secondly, I had exactly the same experience with Dear Esther. It was highly recommended to me, and I was really looking forward to it. I jumped in, and it really wasn't my cup of tea. You know, I don't particularly enjoy storytelling delivered in that fashion. I value my time, and I felt that I'd given it a fair go, and it wasn't for me, so I jumped out. And as you said, it's not that I would not recommend someone to check it out.
Did you try Gone Home?
I haven't had the chance to try Gone Home
yet. A lot of people haven't tried Gone Home because it's similar to Dear Esther in that it's a explore and find out a story, but you can't. Like, you're not necessarily solving puzzles. There's some, like, minor puzzles and stuff in it. But I would, if you're still curious about that genre but feel like Dear Esther's take on it didn't do anything for you, I would recommend Gone Home because I enjoyed that one.
Right. I'll check it out. For me, like, Portal was just perfect, you know. And Portal, for me, was very influential on the way that I like to make games. And it had a big effect on Monument Valley. In the sense that you don't have to do an awful lot to get the story of Portal. Like, it's constantly giving it to you and then asking you to engage. And Monument Valley is the same. It's kind of a low friction environment, if you will. And the other thing I wanted to say was, I 100% agree with what Nigel said about needing to separate our subjective tastes from sort of trying to make objective statements about games. And I think one thing that I've been thinking about a lot is that this medium that we have of interactive entertainment or interactive arts is much broader than what a lot of people think. It's not one industry, and it's not one art form. I think it's become multiple art forms. When you have mobile games and console games and PC games and freemium and you know, serious games, and this is so broad now, and it accounts for so many different audiences, and people consume them and look at them in so many different ways that I think it's impossible to say you must play this game. Like, this game sums up everything that is good about games. I don't believe that. I don't believe there are universally perfect games. I think there are games that will be perfect for your grandmother, and there'll be games that are perfect for your three-year-old son. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I'm going to do a sponsor, and then I'd like to at least touch on sort of realism and immersion, because that's kind of a related topic on this. So this episode is brought to you by Threes, the tiny puzzle that grows on you. Threes is the heartwarming tile-based game for iOS and Android that started a sensation. There are many imitators, but Threes is the real deal. Visit threesgame.com or search the App Store for Threes. And if you're not familiar with the story of what happened with Threes, and Nigel sort of alluded to it, you may have heard of 2048, which is originally was just someone, I believe, just doing a demo of, hey, I can make something like Threes on the web. And then it just exploded into a fractal explosion of basically Threes ripoffs from people who didn't even know that Threes existed.
It's actually even slightly crazier than that, in a way that makes you feel a little sympathy for the 2048 guy as well. That what actually happened is there was a buffer clone that didn't really take off, where someone did like Threes ripoff without crediting Threes anyway. That I think was called 1024. It was the same basic structure as 2048, like Threes without the initial one and twos that you have to merge. And then the 2048 guy saw that and like cloned it, not even realizing that it was a Threes clone exactly. And then his take on it is the one that took off because he open sourced it. Like, it was just a little web app that he published the code for. And then there was a huge number of remixes of it done, some of which are actually quite entertaining bits of art in their own run. The absolute favorite one of those that that I found, which just floored me, is the 2048 number Wang one.
I've heard a couple of people mention that, and originally I thought it was a joke, but this is an actual game.
It is a joke, but it's also an actual game. But it's based on this, I wish I could remember what the name of the show that it's on is. But it's this sketch on like a sketch show in Britain that's like this ridiculous game show that you can't understand the rules for. And then the 2048 number Wang is like it's a version of 2048 that just doesn't make any sense, where things merge in ways that don't have any rhyme or reason. And then eventually you just win the game with no explanation of why you've won the game. Which is basically exactly how the sketch game show works. But I would, if you only check out one of the 2048 clones, that's the one to check out. But you have to watch the original sketches first, I think, for it to make sense.
Okay, I will definitely put that in the show notes. So the thing that I wanted to touch on was this idea of sort of realism and immersion, which has become, you know, it's always been something people talk about on and off, especially with AAA games. But the Oculus Rift and these sort of things have brought this much more into discussion, and this idea that, you know, you need to have immersion, or, you know, it's not necessarily, I don't necessarily espouse this idea, but that you need to have immersion in order to really pull somebody into a story and really tell a story in a way that gets sort of emotional impact. And I've gone back and forth on this, but I thought, like, Monument Valley is obviously not sort of, I mean, it's not even a proper 3D perspective. It has like an isometric feel to it. And so at first glance, you would think that you would be detached from the world of the story because of that. And it's like, oh, well, you know, you're not looking at it and you're like thinking, oh, I am really in this place. But I was sort of playing through it as a, just kind of going along and getting more and more into it. And then I got to that moment where the totem, you know, you get the little totem. I call it a character. It doesn't really, it looks around, right? But I think of it as a character.
Do we need a spoiler warning right now?
Oh, yeah, actually, that's true. Spoiler alert, skip the next 20 seconds. or 30 seconds.
We'll probably be talking about or longer than 20 seconds.
Spoiler warning.
And you should just pause the podcast now and go play the game.
Yeah, you don't have any excuse.
It's like $2.
Yes. Okay, so that's enough of a pause. They've all gone off and played the game, and now they're back. So the totem that is kind of going along with you and helping you out and stuff like that, I developed kind of a companion cube-esque affinity for this object. And then in a level, sort of the end of one of the levels, you go off to sea on a, I don't remember if it was a boat or whatever, but you've gone off to sea, and then you're like, oh, okay, well, you leave. And then you see that the totem tries to follow you into the water. And I literally said aloud, I'm like, no, like I thought it was going to drown. I was like, don't sacrifice yourself. You won't make it. And then I had this like emotional reaction to this little like pile of cubes in isometric view. So I think that was like a good, sort of one of those little moments that shows that, you know, at least a counter argument to the obsession with immersion.
Yeah, we've talked about the companion cube before as well, which I think is another great example of that. Is Portal's a game that doesn't seem very emotionally engaging. Like, it's not something that you're playing through it and you're like really into the story. Like, the story, at least initially, just, it, you know, it doesn't even seem like a story. It's just kind of GLaDOS insulting you a bunch, and that's kind of the, that's kind of the story. And, you know, by the time you get to the end of the game, there's a little more than that. But the companion cube section, I mean, there's no rational reason for people to get attached to the companion cube, but they do. Like, it works for some reason. Even though, Portal's, I guess, immersive from a visual sense. It's a 3D first-person kind of game. But I certainly don't think of it as, like, an immersive story. It's not something where, you know, I felt like I'm there. I felt like I was playing a puzzle game. But then suddenly I hit this companion cube. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to throw it in there. And, you know, that's, yeah, when you can do that, when you can sort of reach the point where something is humanized like that, and you actually kind of feel for it, like that's, I think, where immersion comes from. It's something I don't think we've talked about on the podcast before, but I know Alan and I have talked about it in real life, is that was one of the things that I really liked about BioShock Infinite, and we can, like, spoiler alert for that as well. Probably you don't want to pause the podcast and go play it. But when, towards the end of that game, when Elizabeth gets, like, recaptured and you have to rescue her, like, I was really nervous playing through that section. Like, it stressed me out. Like, I was really worried about what they were going to do to her. And, you know, that's way different from what's going on with the, like, even at the beginning of the game. Like, they're kind of mirroring you rescuing her at the beginning of the game and mirroring all these other examples of, like, the damsel in distress thing. But it's one where I feel like they really earned it. Like, they made you care enough about her that you wanted to, save her at that point. You weren't saving her because the plot was telling you to, even though the plot also was telling you to. But at least for me, like, that's when I sort of realized that something different was happening with that character than happened in most, you know, that happened for most other, like, characters that you're going through a game with, where you actually kind of care what happens to them.
Right. I guess speaking about immersion, it's exactly what you said. I mean, Monument Valley is definitely not an immersive experience. And I personally am not very interested in immersion, never have been. And that's my personal preference. And I'm not really surprised that there are a lot of people like me that have very strong emotional reactions from unrealistic or unimmersive situations. I mean, you look at books, for example. Books aren't visual, rely a lot on the power of imagination or thought, but they can be incredibly powerful emotional experiences. And it's a totally valid tool for games. And I think, you know, a lot of, again, going back to sort of early games, 8-bit games, there are people that had extremely, extremely strong emotional attachments in 8-bit games and 16-bit games, and some of the graphically quite coarse 32-bit era games. And it's through the power of gameplay, it's through the power of just the pure interactive experience. Just like going along with a character, no matter what they look like, even if they're a pile of pixels. One of the games that actually really changed my way of thinking about what a game could be was Passage by Jason Rohrer. And this is a game that's even shorter than Monument Valley. It's about 5 or 10 minutes long. And it's sort of about life in general and how we age. And that was amazing. That it was so short, but it left such a strong impression on me. Even though it's basically pixel art. And it's in a tiny screen. It's in I'm not sure what the resolution is, but it's in a fraction of a web browser that you play it in. I guess that's my opinion on immersion.
Emotional connection, I think, it's the part of immersion that really matters, like connecting to what's going on. Sometimes sort of visual immersion or auditory immersion, like having a complicated game, can get you that stuff in a way that you don't have to work as hard as a, you know, as a writer or as an artist, that, you know, having a world that seems realistic can be a bit of a shortcut for that, some of that stuff. But it's that emotional weight that makes things immersive. And that can be totally independent of how good the art is. You know, like you said, it's not that it's impossible to get that, that just with pixel art. If you're good enough at what you're doing and connecting with people, and people see something of themselves in what's going on in the game, like, people will connect to it and people will be immersed, even if looking at it strictly from a, you know, do I feel like I'm in this world visually? Like, that, yeah, that doesn't matter in the long run to what makes immersion work.
I think there's a limit to that, which is that you still need to, like, you need to have some sort of emotional buy-in to it, and the stranger the visual and audio experience, the sort of more, the further you will be by default to it. And I sort of suffered this a bit with Sword and Sorcery. I'm not sure if either, I think Nigel said he hadn't played it. Have you played that?
I haven't played all the way through it, but I have played
some. Have you played it?
Of it?
Ken, I guess, probably?
Yeah, I'm actually the same. I love it. I think it's brilliant. But I haven't finished it.
Yeah, I'm the same way, that I'm like, this is, and the music is amazing in that game. It's a beautiful music, and it's really interesting and quirky, and I like what they're doing, like, as far as, like, it's this indie game, and it's really craftsperson-like. But I don't know, just the look of it, I never really Like, and it also, I mean, I guess there's two things. One is that the look of it was so abstract that I had a hard time caring so much about the characters. And the other was that the way the story was told struck a fairly extreme balance on the side of being cryptic. So there's a lot of text in the game, and like virtually always, you don't really have any way of figuring out what it means. At least not like I was only maybe a couple hours into the game. But like for the first couple hours, it's not just like, oh, hey, this is an interesting mystery. We don't know this, but it's just like almost all the words. I don't know what any of this is talking about.
Right. Like you get the feeling like it's purposefully obfuscated.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure it was. Like, I think that's kind of their shtick.
Yeah.
But I was a little sad because so many people had enjoyed it so much and it had so many elements that I really liked. But whereas I think, sort of as a contrast, again, Monument Valley does a little bit of that, where like occasionally there'll be little bits of explanation where you meet the sage and he's sort of explaining to you this backstory, and it is cryptic, but it's not cryptic in a way that like every single noun in the sentence is nonsensical, you know?
Right.
It's like, yeah, you know, you came from this past and this is maybe the future, and you're like, okay, I understand what a past and a future are, you know, and you can sort of empathize with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, sorry, go ahead, Nigel.
I think one of the things about Monument Valley particularly is that even though some of the backstory isn't always clear, I do feel like the plot of the game is clear in that you very quickly discover, like, she's going around returning something, right? Like, in you know, the end goal of each level is to reach the platform and put the thing that's in her hat on the platform. And even if you don't know why she's doing that, you very quickly clue into that, and that gives you that sense of like, okay, I know what her motivation is, I know why she's moving through the story, and then as the backstory gets filled in, it's to answer that mystery of like, well, why is this thing happening? As opposed to like one of the things that I found with what I played of Sword and Sorcery is I didn't always understand even where I was supposed to go. You know, that there wasn't a clear path through the game that I could feel like, all right, I've got to keep moving in this direction. Like it kind of sent you back and forth, and I wasn't always sure I was going the right way. Whereas I never had in Monument Valley any sense that I wasn't going the right way. You know,
that's really nice to hear. Yeah, I mean, I love Sword and Sorcery, and I guess, you know, I humbly tried to improve on what it did and what Journey did and what Fez did, by, I guess, you know, maybe skewing it a little bit more towards the kind of games that I like to play. Street Fighter, for example, is very immediate. You know, it's not cryptic.
I'd love to hear
way.
Why Street Fighter and Monument Valley are similar, because on the surface they do not seem similar.
Well, I don't know if they're similar, but the previous game that I designed, which is called Hacky Cat, it's like Hacky Sack but with cats. That was very much based on Street Fighter. If you're looking for my take on that, the game that I enjoyed that Monument Valley is most similar to is Windowsill. Have either of you guys played Windowsill?
I've only heard of it in reference. People are saying, Nevin Murgan tweeted a couple days ago, if you liked Monument Valley, you should try Windowsill. And
definitely.
That's multiple people have made that recommendation, so it's on my to play list.
Yeah. And it's like, so one of the other team members, they showed Windowsill to me early on, before we started Monument Valley, I guess. And when I picked up this game, in another way, it also changed my perception of what a game could be. It's wordless. It's a series of vignettes, and you're not really told what you're supposed to do, except you kind of have this feeling of progression. I think it has so much to say. And again, like, it kind of zigs where a lot of other games zag, you know. We have this sort of traditional way of making games and of thinking of games, and which kind of culminate in sort of your state of the art Last of Us and BioShock and Assassin's Creed and what have you. And then here's a game that's like thinking of games more like art and perhaps less of a game. And I think it's wonderful. I love that we're in a time right now where people are experimenting with what games can be. You know, even the whole 2048 sort of milieu, if you will. You know, we're talking about, you know, open source and people copying each other and making slight modifications. It's almost like a festival. It's like this festival of cloning, which I'm not sure if I agree with ethically, but from an artistic point of view, it's really interesting, right? It's like a whole bunch of people covering each other's songs and making it their own. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that point you make about exploring sort of art that happens to be a game, which was the title of one of the reviews I saw actually about Monument Valley, is a work of art that happens to be a game, is something that's been explored a lot more on the indie side of things, independent developers who don't, simultaneously, they don't have the pressure of a publisher saying this has to make $200 million, so it better be huge and crazy and appeal to everyone and have explosions on the cover. But also at the same time, there's the resource limits where, you know, how many people were on the team for Monument Valley, Ken? Was it like 5 or 10?
It's 8 people.
8 people. So with 8 people, and some people who haven't been in game development might look at Monument Valley and see how long it is and be like, how could it take 8 people? You know, like, it seems like you just draw the levels and then they make walk around and it's like, well, you know, that geometry is not exactly a normal
right. geometry. I think people do appreciate that these levels take a lot of effort to engineer, and therefore that time and personnel, that's they can see where that went into. I think what's more interesting is to talk about Threes, and you know, they publicly blogged that the game took over a year to develop and then was cloned within 3 weeks. And people were like, well, why did it take you so long to come up with something so simple? You know, you're idiots. These guys made it in 3 weeks. I think that's sort of, you know, lit the internet on fire just before Monument Valley came out. And I don't know, it's another thing that we kind of have to come to terms with, you know, when talking about the state of the art and talking about games as an art form is...
Puzzle games are really, I mean, they're really interesting that way, that a puzzle game, once it's completed, should almost seem really simple, right? Like, even something, you know, even a game as small as Monument Valley, like, yeah, like you say, it's clear that there's lots of strange stuff going on there. It's not something that you can just be like, oh, here's the very simple mechanic at the core of this that's distilled down. And but a puzzle game is, like, a good puzzle game, you should look at it and be like, oh, well, that's obvious. Like, of course it's going to work like that. It should, the gameplay rules should almost be like a found object as opposed to something that you've built. It's like the rules have always been out there and you just had to search for them. And once you found them, you look at them, you're like, oh yeah, these are the rules. But that search can take a long time. There's so many dead ends in that process and so many different ways of thinking about it. I'll find something to put in the show notes that I read many years ago, that's something that's always stuck with me about that process, about designing a tabletop game called Zendo or Zendu. I'm not sure exactly how it's pronounced, but it's a game that's about, it's basically about like pattern recognition and coming up with a rule for how a sort of freeform structure is being built. And it's a fascinating story about, like, because he goes through in detail all the mechanics that tried and failed and how they failed and how we ended up at the rules at the end. And you can see sort of the rules at the end are this really polished version of of what, you know, what the concept of the game was, but it wasn't at all obvious from the start that that those were the set of rules that were needed. But once you get to the end, you're like, yeah, well, obviously this is the right set of rules. And I kind of feel like Threes is the same way. Like, it's something where I'm sure it took them a huge amount of time to get the right balance of, you know, what things combine, you know, like even just the fact, like the thing that I think is brilliant about Threes that all of its imitators miss is like the 1-2-3 mechanic. Like, almost all the clones just start with numbers that will combine with the same number, and I think they're way less interesting for that. Like, I think that's the thing from a gameplay standpoint that makes Threes better than them. Aside the issues of the audio design and the sort of character design on the individual pieces and stuff like that, which I think is what gives it its real sense of whimsy and fun, the 1-2-3 thing is what makes it a more interesting game from a gameplay standpoint. And all the imitators seem to have missed that, you know, that they all just built off this like, oh, well, why do we need that? And that's something that I'm sure it took them a lot of time to figure out, even once they got that basic mechanic of the numbers combining, just what the, you know, what the ratios there are. And I wonder, like, it'd be interesting to ask them how much is going on behind the scenes in terms of when things show up. Cause it seems like it's gotta be having some smarts about when it gives you particular pieces. Cause it feels like if it were just completely random, you could get overwhelmed. And there's gotta be some sense of like, if there's too many blue pieces out there, you are actually more likely to get a red piece rather than another blue piece. And that, you know, it could be, I mean, maybe it's just completely random and I'm just, you know, seeing things that aren't there. But if it is true that there's something going on behind the scenes there, it probably took them a long time to find the right, you know, the right constants for that. Cause that's something that could dramatically affect the gameplay if you got that wrong.
Oh, definitely. I think it's been interesting that some people have been saying that 2048 is a superior game because it's not challenging in the same way. You know, like, people maybe find Threes too difficult or too complicated, and that 2048 is more relaxing. And I think that's really interesting, you know, because I kind of liken it to junk food, you know? Like, you take something that's really well made and really beautiful and has a lot of care put into it, and then you take out those elements, you take out that quality and that care and that icing on the cake, which you described, the 1+2=3. And what you're left with is just pure consumption. And for some people, that's, I guess, it's closer to what they want out of games.
Yeah, well, eventually it becomes like a toy, right? If there's no challenge and there's no thought, then it's just kind of like bubble wrap popping. You know, like, just like, oh yeah, move. And maybe, like, there's a genre of entertainment that is that, you know, there's more to be had, I think, in games. One thing I wanted to ask about, Ken, while we have you, kind of my last thing on my list was about, and I'm not sure, you know, you're more on the art side, but you probably would know, how technically challenging was it to get the world in that Escherian sense able to do these rotations where you could kind of follow, you could rotate it in such a way that it seemed to defy the laws of physics and then it looked right again? Right. Is that something that there was like just kind of a clever hack that someone did and then it's like, all right, now we can build it out? Or was this like agonizing, like, you know, process? Right.
That's interesting that you asked that. I think part of the reason that this team was able to make Monument Valley is that even though I come from a background of concept art and art direction, I can also do programming. So I made a game by myself in C# using Unity. And I'm not the best programmer, but I can get by. And then the technical director on the project, who's, you know, he's responsible for a lot of the programming, he's made his own game as well, and he did his own art. So he has a lot of creative opinions, and often I will check with him to make sure that something actually looks good or doesn't look stupid. And that was really, really important that everyone on the team really had could think in of things both in terms of aesthetics and in terms of logic and mathematics, or sometimes illogical, you know, lack of logic. I guess when we started this idea of like, okay, we're going to have levels that are impossible geometry and we're going to make that work somehow, we just looked at how we could do that using computer graphics and sort of 3D, by manipulating 3D space. And eventually what we figured out is we know how to do this. It's all known algorithms. It's all cheating because the computer itself is a cheat. Like when you play a 3D game, you're still seeing it projected onto the 2D screen. And all the mathematics that go into that, it's all fakery. There is no 3D. It's all pixels, right? So instead of faking 3D, we kind of made 3D pretend that it was 2D, and then sometimes we got 2D to pretend it was 3D. But it's all kind of using the computer to do what it does best, really. And I'm not sure if your audience will make sense of that. But
a lot of our audience are in either they're developers or they're into sort of game development, even if they don't actually do it.
Right.
So yeah, that's definitely talking about sort of 3D and 2D and how to make those effects and stuff, I think is something people find interesting.
Yeah, I think I've always had an interest in special effects in movies, especially pre-CGI. So for example, Labyrinth and Terminator 1. And I would watch behind the scenes featurettes and figure out how they did that movie magic. And that's really a lot of the same tricks that Monument Valley uses. It's like just changing things when you're not looking, you know, or moving things at different depths away towards and away from the camera in a way that you don't notice.
And isometric helps a lot with that, right? Like if it was a perspective camera.
Yeah, it's critical to it, actually. I guess the perspective camera equivalent is antichamber. I think it's a bit short-sighted when people make comparisons between Fez and Monument Valley, because there's this very superficial mechanic that we share, which is sort of the whole the perspective trick, right? Flattening 3D into 2D,
Echochrome is the other one that it strongly reminded me of. Have you ever played that on the? I think it's on the. It's a download game for the PS3, but it's the same. It's the same sort of idea. It's all about like Escher style fake perspective, but it's. I mean, other than that one gameplay hook, it's such a different game from Monument Valley. Like, you know, it's a totally different art style and story conceits and stuff like that. Like, you couldn't reasonably call it similar at all.
Right. Well, some people are trying to say that we ripped off Echochrome. I would say that we have more in common with Antichamber. And for me, like the whole structure of Monument Valley as an art piece is more similar to Portal, you know, or even Sword and Sorcery. Like those were much more influential to me.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. People will always, you know, if they have a pet thing and they see someone else learning from that for whatever reason, instead of celebrating that, more things like the thing they like, some people get mad about it. And all we can do is just...
Well, that kind of stuff's part of art, like you said about the 2048 stuff. Like, it's kind of annoying that the Threes guys haven't got the credit for that, but it's also kind of cool that people are experimenting. And, I mean, going back to great art, you know, we said, like, where's video games Hamlet earlier? Like, it's not like Hamlet is something that, you know, Shakespeare produced one production of and they videotaped it and then that's all anyone watches. Like it's a you know, it's a play that's, you know, Shakespeare's plays are great in part because they're so amenable to remixing and modernizing, because they've got such the, you know, such a great core of what's going on with the characters that that in every era since then, people have been able to take them and make them their own. And so, you know, you have to, you always have to balance that in art is, yeah, there's going to be some ripping off of people, but ripping off people is part of what makes the art good sometimes, that calling back to earlier things that, that people connect with is another good way to build that emotional connection in your own games, right?
I suppose great artists steal.
Yeah.
All right. So thanks for listening, everybody. And huge thanks to Ken for joining us. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, Ken is at Ken Wong Art. Nigel is Nigel Brook. And I'm A Pike. See you next week. Yeah. So what's it been like the amount of reception you've received since the game came out is probably, I don't know, maybe more than you expected. Maybe you knew you had something special.
Well, yeah, it has been more than I think we expected. I think I was hoping that we would be approaching how Sword and Sorcery is seen. You know, I mean, Sword and Sorcery, people talk about that as art or Journey. You know, these are sort of iconic classics, modern classics, if you will. And but the conversations that people have been having on Twitter has been amazing. I mean, people have been tweeting that I don't normally play games, but I love Monument Valley, or I actively hate games, but I love Monument Valley. And people are saying that this is the first game that they've finished or the first game that they've played. And they're tweeting pictures of playing with their kids and playing with their parents. And that's amazing. I mean, we were trying to make a game that everybody could finish, but I don't think we anticipated that we would be so successful at it and that we would kind of dominate Twitter. a lot of articles have been saying, oh, by now you must have heard of Monument Valley. So I guess it's kind of a talking point, you know?
I would say probably about 10 people that I follow out of 200 explicitly recommended it on Twitter, which is a pretty good ratio.
That's
yeah, I think
really
I probably, I don't follow as many people as you do, but I think the math probably scales as well. Like, I think I follow 40 or 50, something like that. And I would say I got at least 4 or 5 recommendations out of it.
Wow. That's tremendous. I mean, that's really amazing. We haven't had the chance to like actually go to a games convention, I guess, after the launch. You know, we were at GDC before we came out, and we got a good reception there. But I still didn't get the sense of how Monument Valley fit into the pantheon of games. You know what I mean? And the most flattering thing is, well, I guess one of the very flattering things that people say is that it's the Myst of our time. And that would be tremendous, because Myst was another game that normal people could play, you know?
They probably couldn't beat it, but they could play it.
Exactly. And maybe we're taking things one step further. You know, one thing that I realized much, much later was that we're giving people the sensation of finishing a game. And that's rare these days, you know? It takes hours and hours and hours to finish Bioshock. And then a game like Threes or Candy Crush, you can't finish, right? There is no end. So, and then even something like Dear Esther, you can finish very quickly, but it's quite tough, you know? You have to have a lot of patience and quite a bit of attention span. So already there's that barrier of entry. It becomes kind of high friction. So without kind of dumbing down the experience and without compromising what we're trying to say. I think we were trying to make something that was low friction, that people could get to the end. And just getting to the end would be meaningful. That would be a new experience for a lot of people.
One of the things that I think is really cool about Monument Valley, you know, I mean, independent of obviously the amazing success has been for you guys, is that I feel like it's a game that's helping out with something that I'm kind of worried about, which is the iPad as a real gaming platform, you know, something that, I mean, we've talked about lots on previous episodes of the podcast and in real life and stuff like that, is just how scungy the game environment on iOS is, right? With the, you know, with the in-app purchases and the clones and the cheap cash-ins and the, you know, the successes of games that don't seem to deserve it, like Flappy Bird and stuff that, you know, I want the, like, I think that iOS can be a good gaming platform, but there's so few games that are trying, and that, you know, the fact that something like this has been successful is good, because it means that maybe more people try this stuff, you know, maybe more people will try and make games that are meaningful on the iPad as opposed to real junk foodie kind of games, which unfortunately
I'm not entirely sure that it's not that no one's trying. It's that no one's making money doing it, right? As opposed to, you know, putting out something scungy with in-app purchases, it clogs up the top charts. But there might be the most beautiful, inspiring game ever made that only 3 downloads have ever made, and the guy just quit the games industry, and we just don't even know. It's just sitting at the bottom of the App Store charts.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I don't think we have all the answers. I don't know if anybody does, but you know, one thing that was really that made me think a lot was a friend of mine forwarded me a video, and I can't remember who was in the video, but they were saying that when you remove money from art, perhaps that's good. Perhaps people approach it in a more pure fashion. With the example of poetry, you know, people don't do poetry because they want to run a business or because they want to get rich. They do poetry because they love it. You have to love it. And it's, you know, maybe that I would love it if we could make a living from games, as I'm lucky enough to do. But I don't know what would happen in the industry if money was not a part of it. If we just made games for the sake of making good games.
Well, there's definitely something to be said for money and capitalism as a just sort of lever to help people think about what is going to be something that provides value to a lot of others, right? So if I go and make a game that is only appealing to me because I really like, you know, some obscure genre that I think that, oh, yeah, not enough people are making, you know, these types of games. And I personally don't care about sound, so there's no sound. You know what I mean? Like, if I go off on my own thing, and it's impossible to make money from games, so you don't have that sort of thing in the back of your mind necessarily, that's like, hey, if I want to be able to sort of keep doing this, I need to think about, who else is going to be playing this? Not that, you know, people who are making games don't care about their user base, but I think it's not inherently wrong to have sort of capitalist financial forces behind games. The problem is just when it gets to such an extreme that the only games you can make are Grand Theft Auto and Candy Crush.
Well, and there's the practical issue of just games are more expensive at the bottom end than some other kinds of art, right? That, I mean, poetry is a good example of that. It's very easy to be a poet in your spare time, right? It's something that's a very small product in terms of surface area. It's something that is produced by a single person. You know, games, it's hard to have like a game that's as simple to write even a bad version of as a poem, right? Like writing a bad poem is in no time at all. It's trivially easy, right? Any person can write a terrible poem given like 15 or 20 minutes. Obviously, it takes longer to write a good poem, but you know, for video games, even that is pretty tricky. You'd be hard pressed to produce any sort of even a bad video game given 15 minutes, you know?
Nigel, I wanted to ask, before we were talking about indie games, and, you know, given your background, both from working at Radical and then working at Activision, you know, something we've been talking about a lot at the studio recently is what does indie mean? Does it have any meaning? And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Activision particularly is a weird case of that because, you know, they basically bought themselves back. So they are now technically speaking an indie developer in the sense that they're not a publicly owned company, nor are they a subsidiary of something else. So yeah, it's a hard thing to define. And I do think that line is blurring in some ways, right? That in part because of the distribution platforms, right? Is, you know, is something like Journey an indie game? I mean, it feels like it has to be, like it feels like an indie game, but it's a pretty, you know, a lot of people worked on it, and you like go and buy it on your PS3, yeah, through download rather than buying a disc. But then like the new Wipeout game was also completely a download only game, so you can't say that like just because it's download and it's only $15 it's an indie game. So it and some indie teams are getting bigger. Like I'm sure 5 years ago, having an indie game done with like eight people, like you say Monument Valley was, would have seemed like, well, no, a team of eight, that's like a real game, that's not an indie game, you know.
Whereas if you look at some of the old games for like Commodore and things like that, they're often just one person or maybe,
yeah,
two.
plenty of the AAA titles from 15 years ago or 20 years ago were that few people. So to me, the best definition I've ever been able to come up with of what's an indie game is that the people that are doing it are doing it because they want to make something meaningful as opposed to because they want to make money. That at the high end, the profit and loss is always kind of king. Like, yeah, you know, if you're working on a game that you like, that's better and you'll do a better job. But, you know, everyone at the big AAA game developers has always got to be thinking about like, can we hit, you know, can we have this done by end of September so it can go to manufacturing and be on stores for Christmas so we can make back the budget? And indie developers, you know, obviously there's money going into it, but they I feel like are just more in it for the love, you know. And that, but I mean, that's something that's so hard to draw a line on. And that's one of the things that frustrated me about the console games industry. Like I liked, you know, I like working in it. I like the people I was working with. It was fun, but ultimately there were always things that we wanted to do and we couldn't because it didn't make financial sense to do it, as opposed to, you know, it would have taken too long, or it would have delayed the game, or it would have, you know, it wouldn't have made its money back or whatever. And that, that's part of being a big business like that. Like, I don't fault the people at the big game developers for thinking about it that way, but it's, you know, it's not as fun as just doing your own thing.
Right. Something that I like to one way I like to think about it is I don't think we should have to suffer for our art. I think that art should be about life. You know, art should enhance our lives, especially for us as artists. And I think that means that we should be able to make a living from art. You know what I mean? So I think that if you can find a way to not necessarily water down or compromise your work, but to put your ideas and your emotions into a way that other people can understand and appreciate and reward you for, then there should be a way to make a living from doing art.
Well, that's actually exactly why I think a lot of people do care about the definition of whether or not games are art. It's because as long as they are not defined as art, then you can't get arts funding for it. and a lot of poetry and that kind of stuff, like, I don't know about the UK, but in Canada, we have a poet laureate, you know, and like, I don't know how profitable that is, but it's good to have poetry and it's good to have any kind of art. And I think that's one of the main reasons it matters, is because there is actually ways to make a living doing art that maybe doesn't necessarily involve being profitable on the in-app purchase and things like this. Of course, I make fun of in-app purchase, but I don't want to discourage you guys. If you're considering doing in-app purchase for more levels on Nemanja Valley, I will I will buy them. So.
Good to hear. We are definitely making more levels. We haven't decided yet how that works in terms of, like, do we do an in-app purchase or not? Like everything else, we don't want to have a fixed plan. We want to work out what is best for the product. I've worked on titles that make use of in-app purchases, and I actually think that people need to have a bit more perspective on that sort of thing. I mean, arcade games were like, what, a quarter a pop back in the day in the US, and then like... you have the shareware model, where you get one act of Doom for free and you can pay for the other two acts, and you have demo discs and so on. And I think the way that, you know, freemium works is not too dissimilar, and I guess there's a good way and a bad way to go about it. So I wish people wouldn't assume that in-app purchases themselves are evil.
I think when people make fun of or criticize in-app purchase, they're really criticizing the bad way of using it, which unfortunately is the majority of the usage of it at the moment. But that doesn't mean that there isn't great usages of it. So